From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Chances are that you've seen at least one piece of my next guest's work, although you wouldn't have known it was his. Bob Gill has been a professional artist for over 50 years, much of them devoted to designing graphic arts for various companies. His new book, Logomania, One Problem, 31 Solutions, Plus Other Stuff, looks at just a few of the infinite number of possible logos that can be created for the same company. The book is available from Rockport, and I'm very pleased it has brought Bob Gill back to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
Now, Plus Other Stuff is just part of the subtitle, but it takes over half the book. So what exactly is all that other stuff?
Well, as I say in the on the first page, the first 75 pages is really foreplay. I just showed one logo for each client, which is what is normally done. But what my real interest is that I've been saying to students and to anyone who could listen that there are infinite solutions to the same problem.
But you can't present a client with an infinite number.
No.
In fact, you can't even present a client with more than two or three because then they start wondering whether you know
exactly
what you're doing.
Exactly, one from column A and one from column B. No, on the contrary, I have never shown more than one logo to a client at a time. That's not to say that I presume that this first thing that I show is wonderful and they should accept it and so forth. I simply say that I don't want them to choose my third best. I want to show my best, and if they don't like it, I'm happy to go away and do another and another and another.
But after a while, they start saying, this guy doesn't have the
yes.
answer. So do you have any idea of what they're really looking for? I'm sure they talk to you. They say, we want to present an image of
yes,
such and such.
In one of my books, I say the problem is the problem. That's 90% of it. And so I have to determine. Sometimes I'm able to help them, or sometimes they're very articulate, and they tell me exactly what they're trying to communicate. And then, of course, it's my job to find an interesting way to do it that's unique.
Well, years ago, the Village Voice ran an article in which they suggested that there was a conspiracy based on a typeface, Helvetica, to suggest that companies had a certain kind of respectability. And they showed that a wide range of companies and even the sanitation department all used Helvetica. And I remember I was a designer in those days, and somebody asked me to do a job, and he said, well, whatever you do, do not use that typeface Helvetica. And I knew he was a Village Voice
He's
reader.
He's an expert.
But also, he was, it suggested there was some kind of conspiracy. Well, how much does a typeface actually affect the message that you're trying to get across?
Let me put it this way, that we're all subject to the propaganda of the culture. Starbucks and Home Box Office and the other seven institutions that own the records and the books and the films and the television shows have a terrific tyranny. Obviously, they want us to use their refrigerator, their movie, so they're always saying, this is what's in, this is what's out. And so designers get caught up like everybody else, and they simply want to emulate what these nine institutions, and incidentally, next year it'll be seven institutions, and the year later it'll be six. So, of course, the problem is if you want to do something original, you can't really be tyrannized by the culture because then everybody does the same thing. And the same thing applies to typefaces. At one time, it's Helvetica. Next year, it'll be something else.
It'll be Bembo or whatever.
Exactly. So as someone who's been teaching for a long time, it's hard, but I try very hard to get my students not to be subject to what the culture tells them is in or out.
You said earlier that it's solving the problem. Is problem a better word than job or commission, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think it makes it easier to have a conversation with the client. You say to the client, what do you really want to say? And if the client says, well, my shoes are the strongest or the cheapest or the longest lasting, that becomes the problem. I say, well, then you have to be critical of what I do to make sure that it makes the statement that you want to make. Unfortunately, and of course this is not the client's problem, it's mine. Unfortunately, all of these statements are very boring. So the first thing that one has to do, which is part of the fun of it, is to take the statement that they want to make, and you can't tell them to make a different statement because they know more about their shoes than you do, but you have to refine it in some way so that it's an interesting thing, because I discovered a long time ago that the more interesting the problem, the more likely the solution will be interesting. So that's the first thing.
But if they want you to know they make long-lasting shoes, then you don't want to do something that's elegant, because even though that might look beautiful, it would be sending the wrong message.
You have to serve their statement. But let me just give you a quick example. I had a client who supplied guides to tourists. So they were called Rent a New Yorker. And that was the problem. Well, I'm sure every third year design student would immediately do a logo with the skyline of New York with some contemporary typeface underneath saying Rent a New Yorker. To me, that's pretty boring. So the first thing I had to do was try to convert this problem, which is a very conventional one, into an interesting one. And the more I thought about it and the more I talked to the client and so forth, I realized that if I could communicate somehow, because incidentally, we know that the guides to New York are all out of work actors from Cleveland. They don't know anything about New York. Anyway, I decided that the most interesting statement I could make, the most interesting problem to give myself, was to say that our guides are authentic New Yorkers. They'll really show you New York. Well, how do you communicate that a guide is an authentic New Yorker? Well, eventually I came to the conclusion that if I could give their logo a New York accent, that might in some way communicate that these are real New Yorkers. So I suggested to the client that they spell their name in a New York accent, N-O-O-Y-A-W-K-A, and so forth. Well, they loved it. But that's an example of making what is essentially a conventional problem into an interesting one.
My guest is Bob Gill, who's written many books on design, the most recent Logomania, One Problem, 31 Solutions, plus other stuff. But you also say in your introduction that when you're given a problem, the first thing you do is try to forget everything you knew about it.
Yes, absolutely. Because everything in my head and in every other designer's head was put there by the culture. So if one wants to do an original solution, if one wants to really push that envelope, you have to forget all these cliches and all this information. So the only thing to do, there's one thing to do, you go to the job, so that if it's a logo for a dry cleaner, you don't look through my books for inspiration or sit at the computer. You go to a dry cleaner and act as if you never heard of dry cleaning. And you sit there until you have something interesting to say about dry cleaning.
Other than a hanger.
Or whatever.
Yeah. You began your career, your working career anyway, in England, didn't you?
No. I'm a New Yorker, and that's N-O-O-Y-A-W-K-A. After about 7-8 years working as a freelance designer and illustrator, on a whim, I ended up in London and met two wonderful guys, and we went into partnership. And eventually, it got bigger and bigger. It resembled a law firm, and we changed the name to Pentagram which is still going strong.
Not a bad company.
They still make a living, and they've got offices everywhere except Tibet. But of course, I left a long time ago. It was much too big. I wasn't interested in that.
Well, the question I was going to ask is the business similar over there? If somebody comes to a British company and says, "Design a logo for me," is the process pretty much the same, or are there certain national design preferences?
I don't think so. Just like there's the same GE refrigerator all over the world, there's one sensibility, which the culture, because the nine institutions own all the countries. So, no, there is no. But I'll tell you what...
Well, what about that GE logo? That it's letters...
Well, it was the state of the art when it was done in 1939.
At this point, it doesn't tell us anything, does it?
No.
Other than we've known this since we were kids.
But that's what I was coming to. And, of course, it would be more easy to understand it if you thought in terms of mathematics. Can you imagine a mathematician liking the number 126? So when he gets a problem, he automatically, he knows the answer is 126. Now, as dopey as that sounds, I would accuse 95% of the entire worldwide design community of knowing in advance what the solution is before they know the problem. And of course, that's okay because clients make a living in spite of this, and I'm not that worried about it. But what bothers me is that designers have to sustain themselves 30, 40, 50 years. If you know what the answer is when you get up in the morning, how sad it is that there are no surprises. And that's why I say, go to that dry cleaner, act as if you know nothing about all these preconceptions that are given to you by the culture. Incidentally, even if I don't have a job involving dry cleaning, I go anyway, because if you've ever inhaled the naphtha, it's a hit. It's a nice hit. And then I go on to my next.
Well, dry cleaning does lend itself to certain graphic ideas. But what about the soft professions that don't have anything that's visual connected to them? Is that more fun because you could do whatever you want?
It's been my experience that you never know which job is going to be more fun or is going to turn out to be better or the best one or the worst one you've ever done.
Is that because of the job or because of the client? You do something
no,
you think is brilliant
again,
and the client
no,
says, I don't get it.
It's funny. Of course, clients have every right to say, I don't get it. And then you go away and do it again and again. As this book tries to demonstrate. Now, I only did 31 for the same client, but I hope at least that starts to prove my point that there are unlimited solutions. I'm sorry. I
was talking about the soft professions that don't really have a...
I don't think it makes any difference. You never know. Let me give you an example of a soft profession that ended up as a pretty interesting logo.
We had a PR firm, for example, that you showed here. It was a message in a bottle. That
yes.
was your logo.
Yes. Well, because...
I was thinking of that one.
To me, when I was asked to do a logo for a PR firm, which is soft, you know, what does PR look like? I thought that the fact that you put that message out in a kind of abstract way and just hope that it's going to resonate with someone that was okay. I think that was an interesting solution. And talking about PR, Howard Rubenstein, who also makes a living in this world, trying to represent people and communicate for people, asked me to do a logo. And again, a soft job, PR, how do you represent it? So I thought about it, and I thought what would be fun is to drop a pebble in a lake and see those concentric circles going out and out and out. To me, that represents PR, because at the same time that it's not precise, it feels like that world. Incidentally, he loved it, but his associates hated it. So I never said I was perfect.
When you do the 31,
Yes.
Is the first one usually the one you still like the most, or does number 29 suddenly strike you as, why didn't I think of this before?
As a matter of fact, the first thing I showed 2 years ago when I was given the job, this was long before Logomania, the first presentation I made, this was to a think tank called Applied Minds. I thought they're so smart that if they had been around years ago, they would have invented the wheel. So that was my presentation to them, and they loved it, but they felt, oh, it's much too pretentious, we can't do that. The second present, so they rejected it. I went away and I did another one. The second one, I was in a hardware store, and I saw one of these dopey signs to indicate a staircase, you know, just a couple of steps. And I thought, that is a nice way of characterizing a think tank, because they're always reaching for something. And so I presented the steps. And not only did I present them as steps, but I suggested they die cut the corner of the letterhead. So the corner of the letterhead and their business card had steps to it. And they loved it. And that's became their logo. Then 2 years later, when I thought it would be fun to do as many logos for the same client as possible, I thought that they would be an interesting client to do this for. Incidentally, you mentioned which of the subsequent ones, my favorite one, and I only wish I had thought of it, that I could have rammed it down their throats, was the, because they're such a brilliant think tank, I thought the matchbook under the table was a nice way of representing them.
Now, at one point, we have very little time, but didn't you direct a film called Double Exposure of Holly?
Oh.
I'm not going to go into any
more detail. Are we running out of time? I don't think there's time to answer that, because that would require long answer.
You gave up your film career after that?
Yes. I almost gave up everything after that. Yes.
We'll talk about that some other time.
Incidentally, my next book, I swear, will be called, I Promise This Is the Last Book I Will Ever Write.
Really? You want to give it up? Why?
Oh, I've written too many.
By the way, Bob Gill will be at a book signing tonight, along with Milton Glaser, at the Barnes & Noble store at 7 o'clock in Chelsea. That's at 21st Street and 6th Avenue. And, of course, there is his latest book, Logomania, his next-to-last book, Logomania, One Problem, 31 Solutions, Plus Other Stuff. It is published by Rockport. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for asking me.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.